Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 380. It's a whole lot of episodes, isn't it, really? And you know what? I don't say this all the time, and I'm going to be bold, but this might be the best episode yet of all 380. Yeah, I know that's high praise, and I'm probably forgetting a few, but when I came off of this recording, I spoke to a few people and said that I think this might be the best episode I've ever recorded. It's with Wheelchair Sports Camp, or it's with Kaelin Heffernan, who is the embodiment of Wheelchair Sports Camp, the rapper. A lot of you will have heard me raving about their single "Yes, I'm a Mess" a month or two ago, and Kaelin came up in the B Dolan episode, which was also a really emotional one with the story of the surgery he's been through recently. So I had to get Kaelin on, and as you'll hear, like we've known each other, I put that in quotation marks, we've known each other a minute, but this was the first time we'd properly got to sit down and chat. Like, we've DM'd and we've chatted on socials and all that kind of thing, but this was the first time we jumped on Zoom and we're kind of face-to-face, and I was constantly in awe of this woman. Just amazing stories. And an amazing human. At the end of the conversation, I'm going to pop a little bit of "Yes, I'm a Mess." I've not even cleared that with Kaelin, but I want to let you hear a chunk of that. So we'll have the interview. Maybe we'll come out of it into the track, and then we'll fade that out, and I'll give you an outro and tell you about everything that's going on at the moment. But yeah. I recommend, even now, just pause and go on YouTube and type "Yes, I'm a Mess," Y-E-S-S, I'm a M-E-S-S, Wheelchair Sports Camp, because the video is as good as the song, man. It's a banger in all respects. Yeah, let's get into the episode. Obviously, I mentioned B Dolan there, and we talk about music here. You can get all of my music and merch over at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. We also talk a little bit about how tough it can be to be a musician in the modern age of everything is free. So, yeah, you can head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and support the podcast by buying podcast merch, like my live DVD, which I bang on about a lot, but it's the best thing I've ever put out, or any of the merch. We've got summer merch, we've got winter merch, so you're covered for the average British season. Head over there, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. I will be back at the end. But for now, sit back and enjoy this conversation with Kaelin Heffernan, Wheelchair Sports Camp. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
I'm recording.
So am I.
Okay.
I'll begin then. Right, I'm here today with Kaelin Heffernan, Wheelchair Sports Camp. How you doing?
Hey, good morning. Good. Happy to be here.
I'm glad to be able to chat. How are you holding up in these mad times? Are you in Denver, right?
I'm in Denver. Mad. It's mad. Real wavy, you know? It's like the highs and the lows all in the same feeling. It's kind of like all the emotions we go through, like writing one song, but it's like a kind of daily, just like, and there's no album to show for it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that, because you've, for me, "Yes, I'm a Mess" has been the anthem of this time. But as you said in one of your posts, it's the anthem of the pandemic that you wrote like 3 years ago. So it's kind of weird.
4 years ago.
Four years ago. So how was that? It's kind of, it's mad that it's always scary. I mean, that's kind of, I think it's a positive song. It's reflecting on negative times, but it's a positive song. But me and Dolan talk all the time how depressing it is when you write like a political song or something, and then it remains relevant for 10 years or 15 years. And you're like, oh, I was hoping things would change and this would stop being relevant. Film The Police is a prime example of Dolan's, that it's like he wrote that years ago and we all hoped, oh, this is of the moment. Mm-hmm. And then years on, it's like, no, this is still depressingly relevant. So how was it to have kind of more of an uplifting song, I guess, kind of become relevant to such an unpredicted time?
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. You know, it's like being a futurist without really knowing it. And it is, though, kind of nice to know that, like, the art aged well, because that's something you can't predict. You know, you can hope to write something that will stay, you know, relevant, maybe not relevant, but at least, like, impactful.
Yeah.
And still, like, sound good. And I usually hate my raps, like, right away, you know?
Yeah.
So, this is 4 years old now, and we were playing it live quite a bit, working it out. I've only hated it once so far, so it's
That's pretty solid.
It's pretty good. Yeah.
That's a good ratio. How have you found kind of creativity in this time? Because, again, a weird thing, every time there's something big political happening or socially, a lot of people will be like, man, it's good for artists, though. And I don't think it's as simple as that.
No, it's
like
not.
Sometimes it's really not. Sometimes it's not that kind of, oh, I can lock into this and get an album out of it. But that said, like I've confessed numerous times, I remember I've had times where I've had like a heartbreaking breakup and I'll be in tears going to sleep, and just before I fall asleep it will cross my mind that I'll be like, man, I'm gonna get at least a song out of this, if not a whole record. So
right.
there is parts of it.
Yeah, that's Yes I'm a Mess was a really sad boy breakup, or
yeah,
like heartbreak lesbian shit that I was going through. So it's kind of funny that it would relate to the global situation at hand. But I have stayed somewhat creative, surprisingly, but differently. We were supposed to do a Alice in Wonderland musical last summer.
Right.
So I still had deadlines in the pandemic, and finished writing the soundtrack music of the production May of last year. So that's still kind of like floating, and we're doing mixing and kind of like the finalized touches of that. And then I don't know if you're familiar with Meow Wolf. It's like an immersive art theme park almost.
Yeah, I've heard of it. And you, again, I think I heard of it through you guys, because you've created like a venue of sorts there, right? Or
not quite the venue. There will be a venue, but they're opening a new location in Denver, and we're building a permanent installation, a room, basically.
Amazing.
In this massive place. So, I don't know. It was such a time of like reflection and like being home way more than I've ever been. Like, my apartment's kind of clean now, and yeah, I cook regularly.
Oh, what are you cooking? What have you learned? Like, what's been your go-to? I've got into, while I'm out in Vancouver, I've got into HelloFresh. And I never thought I'd be that guy, but I love that shit, man. Because it's pushing me, rather than just make the things I know, it's making me make a different thing every day. And I'm like, all about it. I should have them as a sponsor.
I meant to try that during the pandemic. I should do it before it's over. My go-to is like breakfast, like huevos rancheros at like 11 p.m.
Love it.
Especially like being creative and being home all the time is like, I can just smoke weed all day and drink coffee and like work on my own time. So then I'm like not actually feeding myself till super late at night, and I want breakfast.
Yeah.
So that's probably like what I've cooked the most. But I've been cute. I've been like, hey, I gotta figure out how to make green chili. It's a very like Denver thing. Or like I've been craving poutine, and I can't go to Canada, so I figured that out. Or like just
love
things
it.
That I really like. So yeah, I've been cooking, making a mess. I'm like the messiest cooker ever. I'm like little, and everything's already like an extra task. So like the kitchen gets wild when I'm making food. I'm usually naked now. It's like, it's Yeah, I've been somewhat creative, just not publicly or amongst others. It's been wild.
I love that post eating. There's a kitchen cleanup and a personal cleanup to do because it's just all got so messy.
It's so messy. It's good that I'm not cooking for other people because, like, I'm a super slow cooker and messy cooker that, like, I don't even know if I would want to serve a ton of people because I'm, like, sweating all in it, and, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, like, more a solo vibe kind of thing.
This is for me. Well, you came up in conversation when I had B. Dolan on again recently, and I've been into you guys for a minute, and B's the guy that introduced me. And he's given me some good things to ask you about as well. So we'll get to that. He was like, I've got some inside scoop story that you need to get off.
Trying to be on Nardwar.
Yeah, 100%.
Not but, surprised.
It came up because you were one of the people that really helped him before, during and after his surgery. He said speaking to you was just a huge thing. I think you were the first person he called. And it's because you've had a lot of surgeries yourself, so you're an OG at these things. So can you give us kind of a brief history of your health kind of thing, of the stuff that you've had to encounter and go through?
Yeah, I was born with osteogenesis imperfecta, which is brittle bones.
Right.
So they didn't know I had it when I was born. I had like a pretty normal birth. And then about 3 months later, my mom heard a break. And by the time she took me in, like I had already had 25 breaks.
Wow.
And they thought she was beating on me. So then she beat on the social worker. So like they almost took me. But yeah, it was like surgeries. I started getting surgeries when I was 9 months.
Oh, man.
To rod my femurs. So my bones break easily. They usually, especially then, they healed fairly quickly. But when they heal, they like bend and curve. Mm. And then you're really susceptible to break that same spot. So putting a rod through the marrow of my bones was like a treatment at the time, and still today for some of us, to keep the bones straight. They kind of like break it as many times as they need to get it as straight as possible, put a stainless steel in there, and then hopefully prevents it from breaking as easily as well. But I was like a growing baby kid, so I'd have to get them replaced every 6 months.
Right.
And spend a big chunk of my little early life in a spica cast, which is like a cast up to your chest and both legs casted, and there's like a bar in between, so you're like all the way flat. I don't even think they do that to kids anymore.
That sounds intense.
Yeah, it kind of was, but I don't know. So yeah, I've had like hella fractures and hella surgeries related to the fractures. I did have my spine fused in high school. So yeah, and I've been on, Bernard and I, B and I have like been on tour a lot together. Yeah. One of the times I did break, some stupid person at show like smacked me from behind, and it broke a rod that was like already just kind of floating in my arm. So I had to come home and like get surgery. I finished the tour. Luckily, it was like this weird break that didn't give me a lot of pain. So he thinks I'm an OG, which I am. But also like what he's been through in like nerve things is like so gnarly. And I'm so lucky that I haven't had to deal with a lot of that. And a lot of people get like really bad spasms around breaks, and I get it sometimes, but for the most part, like I feel like I've been pretty lucky, and I don't have chronic pain like a lot of others with my disability. So I'm tough, but I'm also a little lucky, you know?
Yeah.
I'm always happy to like walk people through surgery and stuff because it is so intense and like scary. And the older, you know, for me, it's just been like a normal part of life, you know, every year at least kind of thing.
Well, that's what I was going to say. The kind of the toughness you casually dropped in there is so much bigger for all of us who haven't been through that than you kind of, yeah, I'm kind of tough, but just knowing, you know, or even just for me, imagining what touring a life would be with, even with a chair, let alone all the other, you know, issues and things, restrictions that the world puts upon you in those situations is unimaginable. So it's one of the reasons I became a fan of your music, it became dope and inspirational to watch either along with the tours with Dolan or whatever else mm-hmm. and go like, man, this is just, yeah, fuck it. Here's some shit we got to deal with. And that's...
it's a circus.
That's the DIY indie rap outlook anyway, but you take it to the next level. It's kind of like all of us have been, man, this was a rough tour. I had to get a train and then I had to do this. And we're kind of, but we do it because... we love the art. And then I look over and go, what the fuck am I even complaining about? Acting like a tough guy. Yeah, I slept on a floor. What does it matter? It's like, no, this is next level shit.
Yeah, but like having it be my whole life kind of gives me a lot, like a one up on everybody to like deal with it, you know? So like when people kind of look at me like, oh, if you could do it, anybody could do it. It's like, no, like I've just been like, I inherited this, you know, his surgery has been some shit and it's something that like, even though my back surgery was more intense, I didn't have like some of the pain that he's having. I had a back brace for a few months, but the older I get, you know, the more death sets in and the more people that I've lost, so surgery is still frightening. It gets more frightening for me the older I get because I, you know, you don't take this shit for granted as much as like when you're just like a toddler and they tell you like surgery again, you know, it's like, okay. Now it's like, oh, fuck, you know, I should probably like eat better and, not smoke so much weed beforehand. And, you know, I don't know. Like, it's no joke. Surgery is no joke.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to jump all over the place in this conversation. And there's numerous things I want to talk about in what you've just said alone. But you mentioned the losing people. And we're going to get to activism as well at some point because it's a huge part of you. But you did a post a while ago, a few weeks back, about a friend that you lost, and it was so beautiful because you spoke of her, of the two of you at a protest and her refusing, or them refusing to tell the police how to use her wheelchair to move her, saying, look, I'm not going to resist, but I'm also not going to help you get rid of me, kind of thing. And it was like so dope to read, such a powerful and intellectual approach to protest and to their disability being part of protest. And it was amazing to see and hear that kind of thing of, again, that resistance, but going, look, you can't claim I'm being aggressive in any way. I'm being as compliant as you like, but.
Yeah. She was a badass.
Yeah.
That was Carrie Ann Lucas, who super badass disability, like icon here in town that was super smart and a lawyer and like had to become a lawyer just to adopt kids, because she was a much better fit than I think maybe her sister at the time, and disabled, especially significantly disabled people, weren't able to adopt, and especially adopt another significantly disabled kid. So she was like, well, fuck that. I'm going to law school and I'm taking this shit to court. And now it's a law that you cannot be discriminated against.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I was really lucky to kind of, like, invite myself slash be invited to sit in the senator's office when the Republicans were trying to take our Medicaid and repeal Obamacare, which the first thing that would have gone was Medicaid. And what Medicaid spends most money on is in-home care, at-home attendant. And that was a really cool time of my life. That was like shortly after I wrote Yes, I'm a Mess, because like I had like my Saturn return. So like I was a fucking mess. Like I was so unstable and just like so heartbroken and just a mess, just like not all the way connected to my body, just feeling like crazy all the time. And I've always gone to protest and been out and been active, but I was in a time in my life where I was like really frustrated that disability wasn't being recognized or prioritized in any of this like new hip intersectional talk, you know, like intersectionality has become a really cool buzzword that's awesome, but like disability was always last or not included at all. And I was going to some Black Lives Matter marches, and like there was one real significant time that like everybody just marched up the stairs and I was at the bottom, and everybody, like, it was just, I don't know, it really fucked me up. And like I wanted to jump on the bullhorn and kind of like talk about the intersection of disability within race and class and every little thing, but then it's like not my place, you know, it's like for Black, I didn't want the oppression Olympics, like never is good. Yeah, so yeah, yeah. I went home and I cried about it for a really long time. And I was like mad, outwardly mad. And then I was like, well, wait a second. Like you have done so much shit, you know, what have you done or what do you know about the disability like justice movement? You know, like I knew Rosa Parks, I knew all these significant like members of resistance, and hadn't known shit about disability and wasn't really part of a community of people with disabilities. So that action really like threw me in such a like organic, genuine, authentic way. And I had recently lost another disabled friend with my same disability who like spiritually kind of like showed up in my apartment the night before I went to the action. And she was also like a big advocate and made me feel like I wasn't doing enough, maybe, you know, like, or that I just wanted to like celebrate her legacy of like constantly fighting. And so, yeah, that was a really big week for me. And even though I was like in a senator's office for 3 days, like it was the most stable I had felt in 3 years. You know, it was like everything started to like align back again. Everything aligned that week. And so I sat in an office with a bunch of these dope ass women that had kind of paved the way. And I learned quickly that Denver was the epicenter for disability justice, one of. We were one of the first towns that started an independent living center and broke people out of the nursing home, young people, to live in their own apartments. And like we were the first city to make transit, mass transit accessible, which ended up after we did it going all around the globe. London had some really cool actions around transit that I just like poked into. So yeah, like everything just kind of like came full circle in this senator's office. And I got to meet Carrie Ann Lucas, and ADAPT is the protest group that I had known about for a long time. And I had been trying to kind of get involved with them. But there's different chapters. I played an inaccessible show at South by Southwest, and ADAPT like almost protested me, or maybe they did. So like I'm familiar, but I had no idea that it was like right here in, you know, like the intersection that they protested the buses is an intersection that I have been to a million times in my life.
Right.
And, you know, just had no clues. So like, yeah, that was a really cool week. And I met some like really badass people that were older than me. I was the youngest-ish. Yeah. I was the youngest and like most, I was super into like activism, but I was on the outside of like the disability crew, even though I'm like just as disabled. So it was dope. And you know, Crip time and Crip life is like sometimes short. So unfortunately, like two people in that office that during that action passed away since. Yeah. Don't take this shit for granted, you know, you never know.
100%. And that sitting was one of the first things that opened my eyes to kind of disability justice and active disability protests. And it's one of those things that every step of these protests provide powerful imagery and powerful thoughts and discussion, because you've got all these amazing people holding an office, holding protests, but then it ends with you being dragged out, handcuffed, and God damn, that's not a nice situation, but hell, is it a powerful image for the cause? Do you know what I mean? To kind of go, look, this is where we are. We're handcuffing people and literally dragging them out of their chairs and all this kind of thing. It's like, this is peaceful protest. There was a point in every Black Lives Matter thing that no matter what people saw, there'd be someone who would argue, yeah, but what happened just before this? Or yeah, but what happened? Who did this? Who did that? It's like, argue against this shit, man. Try and make your argument against this shit. This is it's undeniable, and that's a powerful thing.
Yeah, and that's you know, they knew that pretty like early on. There was a civil rights dude named Wade Blank who moved to Denver, and it was like shortly after MLK and Malcolm X like got assassinated, and he was just kind of like done for, you know, and like needed to switch it up and came here to Denver. and worked in a nursing home as like a youth counselor, and just like quickly realized, you know, like how fucked up it all was. And with that same sense of organizing and like, yeah, like who you put on the front lines and, you know, what makes the press kind of stuff. He was like, well, okay, now we have your own apartment, which is huge. But, like, nobody could go anywhere. Nobody could get transportation to the grocery store or the doctor or whatever. So they organized, and it's been pretty interesting to know how closely connected the civil rights movement and the Black Panthers and the Black organizing efforts influenced and crossed over with the disability protests. Like Denver was a big hub, and the even bigger spot was the Bay Area. This is like in the 70s, 80s, before we made the a federal law protecting us. So, yeah, it's cool, you know, and it's something that like I knew that I had to dig in harder to. And how do you do that authentically? You know, like books don't do the same thing as like relationships and connections and like love and friendship, you know? And so I was just so like lucky to kind of jump into that world in such a like intense, like heavy, powerful way. It was really, really beautiful. And I've always had a knack for, you know, civil disobedience and in that. And I've been to so many protests and never once like one of those that was like putting myself out to get arrested, because it just sometimes it can be like a badge of honor at protests and you're like just getting arrested to show that you could get arrested. It never like felt right, like I would be taking up space more than I'd be helping. But when this happened, I was like, hey, I just read your post about something, and they're like, yeah, you want to come with us, can you get arrested? And I'm like, yep, absolutely. And I called the homie and was like, hey, can you cover my classes the next few days just in case? And sure enough, yeah, we got arrested.
That's madness. So did you grow up in Denver? Is that where you're from originally? Because it's quite a progressive place. Like when I used to tour America, like our manager was from Denver, so we'd start every tour there, and it was particularly for America, but in general, it's always been quite a progressive and a revolutionary place. So do you think it was the perfect place for you to grow up to, with everything that you were facing and the path you've ended up taking?
Absolutely. And I was born here and I lived in LA for a little bit till I was like 8. So I moved back to Denver when I was 8, and it just, there's something about this place that's so like, it's weird. And I've always felt it and known it. Like when I go back to LA, like LA is not home. It never really has been. Yeah. Denver is just this really unique, weird place that's, it's got to be the mountains, but it's a portal. It's a vortex. It's like, it's wild here. It is the Wild West. And we have, and again, the more relationships I have now and the more that I learn my history and stuff, it's like, oh yeah, no wonder I feel this way. It's like we were one of the hearts of the Chicano movement, the Chicano power movement. And also, like, you know, this mass shooting once again happening here at home. Like, we've been the birthplace of a lot of massacres, like going way back to the Native American situation, where like here there was like a peace camp of like elderly, disabled women and children that like got massacred, and then they paraded their body parts like through Denver. So like, and the white feminists like organized to get the KKK in power, and our Chinatown was like burned down by white supremacists and Columbine, you know, like it goes on and on and on, the amounts of like violence that has happened in this place that we know as Denver, which is like stolen land from genocide. But there's always been this like really radical like resistance counter. I don't know. Like there's definitely a hardcore spirit of resistance here that I've never been able to articulate. It's just like a feeling, and going on tour and traveling more, I'm like, man, Denver really is special. Like I'm biased, you know, but like it is this place. And looking back on the history, like it's been this place for a long time, and it's kind of like a magnet of weirdos, and there's a pretty, it's a great place to be creative because you're so like landlocked and surrounded by mountains, but it's like a big city, small town. I don't know. Like, yeah, Denver is home.
You're literally in a bowl of surrounded by mountains, just in this petri dish of just creativity and,
kind of. We're not quite at the bowl. Like, it's also directionally super easy because the mountains are west.
Right.
So actually east, it's just like plains. But west is also like the continental divide. It's like where all the water goes either to the Atlantic or the Pacific. So and even though we have the biggest mountain ranges, whatever, right here, like the city itself is pretty chill when it comes to like weather.
Yeah.
You know, we don't get mountain weather, and our winter, we get hella sunshine here. So like, it'll snow 3 feet and be gone within 3 days.
It feels to me like culturally and politically, it's comparable to when hip hop was kicking off, and the whole, you know, Manhattan keeps on making it, Brooklyn keeps on taking it. Everything that's great and progressive about LA happened in Denver first. All of this, like, I love LA. I think there's so much good shit there, and it can be so progressive and so warm and receptive to artistry. But they've got it all from Denver. of the progression and all of the thought. Like, they've got weed now. Denver had weed. Denver had weed. It's exactly. They had this covered. And
And it's been part of our culture for so long. Before the legalized, and even when we were trying to just do it medically, it was I remember getting my license from this sketchy ass situation. I moved back here to Denver again when I was eight and a half, nine. And the kids that early are like, "Yo, you smoke weed?" And I'm like, "What?" And they're like, "Yeah, we're going to go get high." And I'm like, I knew about meth and hard drugs, growing up in LA with a drug addict mom, but weed, and it's everywhere. It's a vibe here for sure. We're a really strange place in the United States. It does influence my everything. I've always been a Denver kid. But, the more involved I got and the more connections and loves I've made, the more I'm affirmed in, why Denver is this place that I call home,
I love it. So what was your route into rap, into music, into the arts?
I was in L.A. I was 5, and I heard Power 106 on my Walkman, and it was instant love. Instant. I have a pretty vivid memory of just listening to my own Walkman while in the car with my dad and finding Power 106 and was like, "You gotta check this out, turn this on." And he turned it on and was like, "Turn this shit off." And I was like, "That's my jam." I know. So TLC was the first album I was able to convince my parents to get me. I'm the only child. They were separated. So I had to work the angles, to get these albums for a 5-year-old. And that album, Ooh on the TLC Tip, was my everything. And I'm 5 with this safe sex public service announcement. I knew fucking every word. Left Eye was everything to me. And then I got into Salt and Pepper. Very Necessary came out the same year. 92 was a great year for rap music for me. And I was just a baby. I should not probably have been memorizing all of that.
I mean, that's the earliest start I remember of speaking to anyone of when they got into hip hop. That's some people are I was in my teens and whatever else. You're like, no, yeah, I was young.
Yeah, I was young. And that, again, being an only child and being in Castle a lot and just having to spend a lot of time alone, that was my shit, It was my everything. I think it was rap music was my first identity and just the first thing that I knew was mine, and it wasn't my parents and it wasn't even necessarily everybody around me, it was just defined who I was stylistically and just energetically. And at the time there was a lot of women doing it, Missy Elliott and shit, so that was pretty empowering at the time. And I was already a tomboy, so then when TLC came out with Hat to the Back, I was oh, finally somebody gets me, finally in my 5 years of long life. It's been my everything. I wrote my first, I didn't start writing raps though until I was 12. I wrote a rap about the Broncos winning the Super Bowl for a talent show.
Amazing.
And I did the talent show every year after that. And then high school, I was okay, I'm going to do it, And it's a fake it till you make it thing, I wasn't actually rapping, but I had decided I was a rapper. I wasn't hard rapping, made a couple songs here and there, took senior pictures with the microphone, And then, I wasn't planning on going to college really. because I just wanted to be a rapper, but I got a scholarship and found a pretty cool program in town to do like the I started making my own beats in high school too, because I couldn't afford to like pay dudes to make them for me, and I couldn't afford the studio time. So I got a job at 15 and just saved up and bought a Roland 909. And once I got that scholarship, I was like, cool, I could learn to make beats better, like produce better. So I got a degree in recording engineering, but I was really just using like all my school time and credit hours to record myself and the early wheelchair sports camp. And then started wheelchair sports camp around college with the same dude that I had been rapping for with since like middle school. And just kept at it. And the more like involved I got, the more we were asked to do like a lot of benefit shows and like actions. And so like it just kind of all worked together. And then that's how I got my job teaching. There's another, the Flowbots here in town had like a pretty big record 1 year, and they started a pretty awesome nonprofit to teach music to underserved youth in the city. So I started like working through that, and I don't know, rap music's just got me into all these things that I never expected. You know, I never thought that my life would like get any bigger than rapping. Like rapping has always been the pinnacle of everything. You know, and now it's like some people know me just like as an activist, or I rolled for mayor now. Like a lot of people don't even know I rap, like done some little TV episodes, teaching, you know, now we're like building. Now I'm an immersive installation artist, you know.
I love that shit. Well, I mean, speaking of rap being everything at that age, one of the things Dolan told me to ask you about was pimping wheelchair access to meet every rapper ever. So.
Oh yeah.
How's that been?
Yeah, I definitely think I like chose this body because I would be like in a lot of trouble if I could be. I'd be very violent, like my DNA is. Program to be. So yeah, I exploited the shit out of my disability. I still do, you know. It's so weird, like it's such a weird thing of being like dehumanized so often that you can get away with like murder.
Yeah.
It's kind of, and a lot of that also has to do with like my white privilege and being like a white girl, and I can speak however I need to like get into places. I used to sneak backstage all the time at every hip-hop show. I've met everybody. Like, everybody.
Love that shit.
Like, natural-born scam artist, for sure. Before Photoshop, like, a rapper would be like, oh, give this to that girl over there. And then I'd, like, photocopy it so that, it, like, the year changed. And then I knew, like, the entrance, so, like, I just would be like, oh, so-and-so told me to come here. You know, like, oh, Ludacris told me to come back here. And they're like, okay. It's easy. Because, like, I'm so pitied, you know? Like, people always want to take that photo op with, like, the Make-A-Wish kid. So I was like, yeah, I need to make a wish.
I'm going to make all my wishes.
That's right.
I love that shit. So when you got into touring life, because you spoke about not realizing in your own town some of the failings in accessibility and things like that, how's it been to kind of tour the whole country and be confronted by all of these different restrictions as someone with a disability, and to be like, right, wow. And as you said, in Austin, almost being protested for playing somewhere that had bad access. And yeah, how was that to kind of tour about and go, oh, right? Because B said, like, the shows he's had with you have been so eye-opening for shit that he wouldn't have noticed as someone who's not got a chair or whatever else. He wouldn't have noticed, but touring with you has opened his eyes to so many shitty venues, essentially.
Yeah, Because he has to carry me everywhere. You know, that's been like the interesting dynamic of it is like, I haven't been super limited by touring, but it's because of like the privilege of being tiny and being like stupid enough to trust drunk dudes to carry me everywhere. And like, I don't know, that's always been my lifestyle and how I was kind of raised is like, fuck it, we're doing it. Like, I never even really had a choice as a kid. Like, no, that looks dangerous. And my parents would be like, you just got out of a cast. You're going, you know, like, so it actually kind of confronted a lot of my ableism and checked me and brought me closer to that disability justice community that I didn't think I had a part of or that I had no relationship to, because I had been playing in Denver for like quite a while before touring, and I would play in accessible places here and get carried. And there was a time where I was like, man, I'm going to feel like the biggest asshole ever if somebody in a chair comes to see me and I'm down in this basement. So I started kind of doing it on my own of just like making sure that I post on my website, like where I'm playing and how accessible it is, just in case. Mm-hmm. But like hardly ever did I see visibly disabled people at our shows ever. And so I didn't have to think a lot about it until going on tour and our first big national tour. We went to San Francisco. I didn't book the tour. We were support. We played at Cafe du Nord, which is like a historic spot. Yeah. Also in the basement.
It's the only place I've ever played there. I've played there two or three times. But yeah, it's a basement, right?
It's a basement. Yeah. And that's where all the radical Crips are. And so I got hate mail. And they were like, what the fuck? You know, like... And I didn't even know up until then that, like, disabled people were listening. And so I was like, fuck. let me try to find a spot that we could play an accessible show before the inaccessible show. And I hit up some homies and wasn't able to lock anything down. So we did, like, a free busking set. Like, we just played a whole set on the sidewalk before Amazing. The show.
Yeah.
And that's where, like, I really had to, like... sit with myself and be like, you know, like I've taken these opportunities because I can. And you know what I mean? Like I still play in accessible places because I can. But now like I have this more moral thing that I'm like, fuck, like, is that cool to like, just because you know, I don't know. Yeah. It's been a hard thing for me because of course, like, once I get carried down the basement, that in itself is huge and, like, a statement. And then I'm on stage and I'm, like, cussing everybody out about the access. So, like, to me, I'm still kind of, like, infiltrating the spot to, like, yeah. let it be known that this is, like, cool. And I'm so grateful to like have been in that historic building, but like that's so shitty that so many people aren't afforded that chance.
Yeah.
So I guess that's what touring has like really done for me, is just kind of like dealing with my own ableism. And there was that time at South By where it wasn't accessible. We were playing with B upstairs and then they were like ready to change our set to a spot downstairs. I was just hoping to add a set, you know, like an accessible set.
Yeah.
But the dude downstairs is like a Zionist rapper. And I'm like, okay, do I hate the handicaps or do I hate the Palestinians? And it's like, well, yeah. I'm crippled enough that I think I can hate on them. So I played the upstairs one, you know, because I don't know. That's just where I was at. And there were a couple of disabled people that came and had all the homies like carry them up, which isn't safe, you know, like in disasters, That's not a, you know, we're the first to go, you know, there's no exit and shit. And bathrooms, like when you're getting carried upstairs, like bathroom gets weird because usually it's back downstairs.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's been interesting, but I do my best to like use my platform to like speak on it. And it's something I do because I'm afforded, like, because that's my privilege. Like, I hang out with Galen. I don't know if you heard of Galen. She also has my disability and is culturally appropriating my name, but she's not gay. And she plays the violin, and she won Tiny Desk a while ago.
Right.
So she got thrown into touring like that. Yeah. She went from like playing in her bedroom to national tours, and she travels in her power chair.
Right.
So, like, that's the other thing is, like, when I tour, I'm in my manual chair, and I'm okay with being carried everywhere, but I prefer to be in my power chair because it's, like, way bulkier, and I can, like, get around better.
Yeah.
So, if I was touring in my power chair, like, everything would be different, you know? Yeah. I wouldn't, one step in this power chair is, like, a lot. Let alone like a flight of stairs or getting up on the stage. And that was something else I realized, like, because I've been going to shows since I was a baby and toddler. I mean, like, yeah, I've been going to shows. I've been an audience member forever. So access is very different as an audience member than stages. Like, it's very rare to have an accessible stage.
Yeah.
Way rarer than it is to have like an accessible section, you know?
Yeah. It's a crazy situation to have been on both sides of. And then, as you said, a crazy thing to have to take into consideration, because all of us, you know, we're trying to get gigs. We're trying to get up on stage. Like, we're trying to get out there and build an audience, particularly on support shows and things like that, and support slots on tours. So to have to have the added, you know, responsibility almost put upon you to go, well, are you going to agree to play that show when it's right. this? It's like, well, man, I just want to play, but I get it as well. So, yeah,
right.
It's mad.
Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard. And then, you know, there's places outside of the country that are just like way old. I mean, we've toured Mexico. Like,
oh, man.
There's no access. Yeah. And I want to come, you know, play Europe more. And I know that like those buildings are way older than here, so like,
yeah, again, as soon as you were talking about that, I was thinking about all these iconic venues in the UK that are basements or are up a load of stairs because they're old buildings, and it's just not good enough. It's not. Yeah.
I want to go. Yeah. You know, like, right. I do, and I'm very lucky and humbled to like be in this very visibly disabled body and yet still have a body and a stupid head that's like ready for that adventure, you know? Because, and I do think it still like has its own, I mean, like Bernard Bidolin, you know, like by me being as crazy as I am, like now he's forever changed because I'm like, okay, we're staying in this apartment. You ready? I got us an apartment to stay at. It's four floors up, you know? And yeah, that like that's the very least I can do. And that's always been my purpose before I was able to know. It's like just making relationships and like taking it to the fullest, you know? And touring has really been a big piece of that. It's like, you know, the feeling of just like, it takes so much to like book a tour and to get out on it. But once you're in the car or the plane or wherever, it's like, it's diving off a cliff,
yeah.
You know? And it's such an exciting, it's such a drug, you know, that you're in for or not. And I'm in for it for sure. And traveling, but traveling even before touring has always, yeah, been interesting and trickier. And, you know, I don't take my power chair anywhere traveling. Right. Like the airlines, I don't trust. I mean, the airlines, like, destroy, I don't know, hundreds of wheelchairs a day.
Yeah.
It's like, this wheelchair is like $20,000. Like, I cannot afford to lose this chair. Like, well, literally.
Well, when you do get to come to Europe or the UK, you know, if there's anyone listening now, or we'll do some kind of setup that will get some kind of UK power chair sponsorship deal to hook you up upon arrival and take care of this shit. Well, I mean, we're at the hour marks, so I'll start to wrap things up. But I mean, speaking of making relationships and wreaking havoc, there were two things on Dolan's list. One was smoking weed in an alleyway with Doug Stanhope, and one was getting arrested outside of a show in Denton with Dolan. So which one do you want to go into, or do you want to explain both?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, it's got to start with getting arrested in Denton, because that's how we met.
Right.
I had seen that Dolan came through because the person that was supporting him was like I actually am not a super hater, and I'm like pretty loved by Denver and love everybody in Denver. But there is one act at the time in particular that I just despise. And so they were playing with B. Dolan, which made me look into B. Dolan. And he was headed the same direction as South By that we were. And I had just got us like an official spot. And so I tweeted him, like a fucking weirdo in early 2000, and was like, hey, I see you're going the same way. If like you need support, let me know. And he had already heard of me through some other rapper. And so he's like, yeah, I would love that. Like, those other Denver guys suck and they're not going to come on tour with me. I'm like, yeah, I could have told you that. That's why I didn't come to your Denver show. And so we played Albuquerque, and then Denton was the second show. And this is our first time out, my first time out of Denver. And it was like the fire show. Like, people were chanting and asking for encore. I mean, it was like a hype show.
Yeah.
And my first real time out. And so, like, and we had a some spray paint with us, and we just like went ham. We're like tagging smiley faces on the sidewalk and hanging out. And it was like a college town. It was like a cool vibe, but it still was Denton, Texas. So we were headed out, and we went to the apartment that we were going to stay at. And one of the roommates had called the cops on us. And like, you could smell it as soon as we got up there. It was like, uh-oh. Like,
yeah.
My girlfriend at the time was like, everyone in the wheelchair sports camp crew, time to go.
Right.
And we like jetted, hit the highway, and the car in front of us got pulled over and seized everything. And then I like laid low for a while, changed our clothes, did all the things, you know, hid the bodies, and then circled around. And our car with the trailer of band gear was getting towed.
Oh, shit.
And so I was like, fuck, I need to follow them so that I could get it out of tow and pay for it. And then they led us into a trap. So then everybody in my car got arrested. And I'm sitting on like a half ounce of weed. I got spray paint all over my chair. And they would not take me to jail because of my wheelchair magic. And
I love that. That you could change your clothes, but the guilt was all over your chair. You couldn't hide this. There was no switching that.
From years before, too, you know? It's like years of spray paint. And so everybody went to jail, basically, except me and my TJ at the time. And rest in peace, B Money. And I was like, fuck, B, we all got arrested. I got to bail my girlfriend out, da, da, da. And he's like supposed to go to a show in Austin with some rappers, what fairly well-known rappers. And he like was like, fuck that. I'm going to stay and make sure y'all get this covered. And he did. He like hid the he helped us hide the bodies and we got everybody out of jail. Eventually, my girlfriend ended up having to go back. I bailed her out and then like they took her back. It was a nightmare first trip. Nightmare. But a hell of a first impression. And it actually gave us all this press. So when we did roll into South by Southwest, there was actually people there, which was cool and like unexpected. So that's, yeah, that's how our love affair started. So like, of course, every tour, like there's something crazy that happens. Like I don't tour with weed anymore ever since then. Like it was not worth it. And I don't spray paint on the road hardly ever, but you know, it was our first time out. It was a blast. And then we've made that trip to South by would be a handful of times. I want to say like a dozen, but that would be exaggerating because it's 2021. But that was 2011. So yeah, like most of the decade making that trip, and the trips got longer and the loops got bigger. And then we would sometimes do like some other runs outside of South by, but South by was usually like an anchor for us. So there was one time we were there and the homie was like, let's go to this comedy show. And it was Jeff Ross, like roasting people who I had no idea who the dude was or what roasting was. And he's like, okay, everybody's favorite time to roast, like any ugly people, any easy person to pick on. And all the fucking bullies in my band are like, Kaylin, you gotta. And I'm like, no. And then they carried me on stage non-consensually, and I got grilled. Like I quickly picked up that it was like signing up to lose a rap battle, which I can do. So I got roasted by Jeff Ross.
Yeah, after. It's like a one-way rap battle, right?
Yeah.
A rap battle with no response.
Yeah. And I just had to like eat it up and it was fine. And then I was like, okay, well, that was fun. You want to go smoke weed? And he's like, dude, you are so punk. I can't believe you put yourself up there. And I was like, well, I didn't, but he talked about us on NPR like a year ago and was like, yeah, she just like wanted to be normalized. And I'm like, well, but not quite. Like, I didn't know. I didn't actually know what the fuck I was getting into. But yeah, so like made homies with Jeff Ross after he fucking grilled me for being little.
Madness. Well, I mean, speaking of it being 2021 and that route to South by Southwest not happening this past year, probably not happening this year. One of the things that's been a highlight for me in this period has been Netherrap and Dolan building this Minecraft rap gig. And the excitement as it was like before it was announced of seeing the stages that were being built for different people and seeing the group email go out saying, if there's anything you'd like for a stage, just let us know. And seeing the instant obvious nature that the wheelchair sports camp stage was going to be a police station on fire, which was just in Minecraft, was such a genuinely powerful and beautiful image. It was kind of obviously over the top, exaggerated, but so accentuated because it's in this weird kind of essentially a kid's game that's been co-opted for a festival for people of all ages. So how was that to play a gig in Minecraft and have that mad location?
No, it was so fun. That was so much. I could not believe how much fun I actually had inside. It was super weird though, like putting a set together in headphones.
Yeah.
Like it actually was really good for me to think about a set so intensely. Because I'm the type that's like, we show up. Like, I'm so busy trying to get the band there at soundcheck and myself there at soundcheck and making sure I got everything that I don't usually figure out the set till like on stage. And even then, it's like pretty flexible, you know. So, yeah, like to really have to think about a set like that made me really like have to focus. And it was like so nice for me to rap into a mic and be like, oh, yeah, I fucking rap. Like, I'm a rapper boy, you know, like it just felt so good to like do it. But it was way different and like way more pleasurable than I expected. And yeah, like I was so thrilled to be part of that. But that's the thing about B, that it's no wonder like we somehow connected. We were bound to be best buds, because that fool has consistently put together weird shit his whole, you know, I mean, yeah. Like I am definitely a freak show circus entertainer, and that dude is always looking for weirdos to like cultivate this cool and curate this cool, like multi-genre, multi-age, multi-race, you know, like that dude. I look to him so much for creating festivals and lineups and show experiences, you know, like being part of Church of Love and Ruin, and even just the work that we put into just announcing our little tours together is like, it's definitely outside of your typical get out on the road and play with whoever, you know. He's very intentional about curating artists. And so, yeah, of course it was the best.
the jealousy I had when he'd be doing these Church of Love and Ruin lineups with you guys, with Vodka, with Katya, with wrestlers thrown in there, all sorts of just crazy performances. And I was like, man, I'm half a world away. And obviously he did a Church and a Love and Ruin thing in the UK, but it had to be somewhat stripped down because just getting the What Cheer Brigade over and stopping them from being arrested every night was enough of a job. Yeah. So adding too many other people was tough in itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to go overseas with them. I did get to go to Bestival. We played Bestival one year. But I unfortunately didn't do what I needed to do to, like, make a run out of it. We didn't really have, like, the name quite yet for it. But I'm still so pissed that I didn't just spend a day in London. Like, we spent more money going and more time traveling than we did on the Isle of Wight. Like, it's so stupid.
Yeah.
So stupid.
So I'll wrap things up by asking, what is ahead? Musically, socially, personally, you know, what do you see on the other side of everything that we've gone through in this last year?
Well, this musical, Alice in Wonderland, is going to happen this summer with a family group who is the first theater company in the States of all disabilities. So they're a theater group that's been holding it down here for 30 plus years, high caliber disability theater group. And this is their first original. So I'll be the Cheshire Cat head. And we wrote all the music that I'm super excited about. And so there'll be an Alice in Wonderland album. And
amazing.
Yes, I'm a Mess was the first single off some kind of project. I don't know if it'll be a full album or an EP, but there's definitely songs from that era, from my Saturn Return, Real Lover, Heartbreak shit, that I hope to finish by the end of the year and put out. So we'll be dropping more singles until that baby's out. And then Meow Wolf will hopefully be open by the end of the year. And personally, I can't wait to like travel again and get back out and play and go to shows. I really miss that and want to do that. And it's been a couple years because I rolled for mayor for a whole year plus. So there was no real touring during that, except we did like a a quick run through prisons, but that's not quite the same. So yeah, touring, traveling, dropping these projects that we've been working on behind the scenes for so many years, and just being loved in real time. I'm so stoked for that. I'm vaccinated, so just had a birthday and was like cheek on cheek, please, to everybody who's vaccinated.
Amazing. Yeah.
And just like really trying to push myself, you know, outside of like rap music's my anchor, but like kind of pushing into new things. Like, I don't know, maybe I'll be on your show or something. And I need to get into like voices.
Yeah.
That's something I've always wanted to do. And like, this will be my first acting thing, but maybe I'll do that. I don't know. I don't know what the future holds. But fuck, we made it to 2021, so.
Damn right.
Can't be that bad.
I love it. Well, thank you very much for coming on. It's been such a pleasure to just, I mean, podcast aside, it's been a pleasure to get on. You know, I know we can't do it face to face at the moment, but to get on Zoom and chat and
same. And thanks so much for like supporting, and you know, like, you're my biggest hype man, I think.
I get overexcited and I worry sometimes. I said this to you before, I worry sometimes that I'm going to annoy people with the constant tags of, yo, check this shit out. It's amazing.
I appreciate it. We don't have like a big publicity team, so you're it. You're hired. I appreciate it. And I've been, you know, following you from afar for so long through B, so it's also super great to connect and see your face. And
I can't wait for all three of us to be able to hang out and it be some kind of gathering from many different locations into the real world, projected at once.
I'm gonna show my whole ass.
I mean, I've got to end it on that, right? It's got to be the end. Perfect.
Showing my whole ass when it happens.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. I told you it was a good one. I hope I didn't overhype it, but I don't think I did. I don't think it's possible to overhype that episode and that human. What a human. Next week's episode is also a banger. You know, I sent round a few bits of hype about this week's episode, and then the next day I recorded a chat with someone who at the time was in quarantine in Australia, and I came out of that one going, was that better? Have I just recorded the two best episodes I've ever recorded? But yeah, spread this one around, please. I think it's
a fantastic one. So spread the word. Obviously, when we have like fucking Mary J. Blige on, or Michael Fassbender or Simon Pegg, the word kind of spreads itself. But with these smaller, more personal stories that you may not already be familiar with, it's really incumbent on you guys to spread the good word. I believe in you. I think you're wonderful. As I record this, I'm about to go into quarantine. Or when you hear this, it will be, if you listen on the Wednesday, it'll be my first day of 10 days of quarantine. So I might jump on and do another Patreon Zoom hangout to fill the time, one or two. So if you want in on that, head over to patreon.com/scroobiouspip. You can find me there. Yeah. Yeah. That's about that. What a podcast. What a human. And I think if Wheelchair Sports Camp do come to the UK, I want us to find a sponsor to hook up with a dope electric wheelchair for whilst Kaelin is in this country. I basically want all sorts of hookups to make it so that someone can come to another country and live a comfortable and normal life in their time here, rather than be restricted because they can't necessarily afford to pay huge amounts to bring their basic comforts with them. Yeah. We're going to get back to that if this shit happens, because I'm going to go all out, balls to the wall to make people act right. Anyway, it might not happen. Who knows if the world will ever open up properly again. I will see you all next week. As said, it's another cracking episode. And I'm recording just some killers at the moment. So you're in for some treats. I've got big plans for May. I still don't know if they're going to happen. But basically, I've teased the big plans for May, but I'm not going to start working on them until this quarantine starts, because I need that kind of time and I need to be on the right time zone. And there's a lot to go into them. There's a lot of work for them. Buddy Peace will be hearing this and being delighted. Yeah. But if we can pull it off, May's going to be a big one for the Distraction Pieces homies. Yeah, but if I don't, then you'll just get normal episodes and I'll pretend I never said any of this. And in reality, no one listens all the way to the end. So if a pip makes a promise and nobody hears it, did it ever really happen? Stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.